From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
This is Josh Barrow, and you're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. I'm joined, as always, by Ken White for our weekly exploration of Donald Trump's sprawling legal issues. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com, and he hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law. Hey, Ken.
Hey, Josh.
So we're taping a few hours later than usual this week. We're taping on Wednesday afternoon, August 15. This is just after the end of closing arguments in Paul Manafort's trial. But before we get into what was in those closing arguments today, I want to talk about something that happened earlier this week, which is to say the prosecution rested and then the defense rested, having called no witnesses. A lot of people reacted to that with surprise, sort of saying, well, what does it mean that Paul Manafort's defense chose not to call even a single witness? Ken, should people be surprised by that?
No, it's not unusual at all. You have to remember that it's the prosecution that has the burden of proof. If they don't do it, then the case is over. And often a defendant will look and see that, you know, whatever witnesses they can put on don't really help their defense and may just expose them to more bad things. Frequently, the government does not have to reveal everything it might know about the defense's witnesses. If it's not something the government's going to use in its case in chief, and if it's not something that's exculpatory, helpful to defense, they're not obligated to turn it over. So you could put up a defense witness and find out some very unpleasant things about them after you've called them. There's another reason to think they may have decided not to move forward with the defense, and that's about opening doors. So there's a variety of evidence that generally the prosecution can't put in to dirty somebody up unless they open the door, unless they put on witnesses making those things an issue. So there was a sealed hearing out of the public with the judge and the prosecutor and the defense, and it was after that that the defense made the decision that they were not going to call witnesses. And my friend and colleague Mitch Epner, another ex-AUSA, a very smart guy, speculated, and I think it's pretty well supported, that the judge may have made some rulings about what sort of things the government would be allowed to get into if Manafort started calling character witnesses or other witnesses to support his side of things. So sometimes it's just a strategic decision that you don't put it on a defense, because if you do, it makes things worse for you. It opens the door to more bad evidence, and you may lose some of the benefit that you've gotten from good cross-examinations in the government's case.
So, Ken, it sounds like from what you're describing there, a defense conceivably might choose to call no witnesses when it feels it's in a strong position and also when it feels it's in a weak position. So I guess we can't infer anything from that choice about whether, you know, whether the defense is going well or going poorly.
Exactly. It could be the defense thinking, you know, we really rocked their world with that cross-examination of Rick Gates. Or it could be the defense thinking, you know, things are bad, we're going to have to hope for a pardon. But either way, you can't draw a strong conclusion from it.
There was also this moment before they went to closing arguments where Judge Ellis, without the jury present, specifically asked Paul Manafort to affirm that he did not wish to testify in his own defense. Why did they need to ask him that specifically, given that his lawyers had already said that he wished to call no witnesses, which presumably included not calling himself?
Well, it's not required, but it's something you see increasingly from careful federal judges. So one common thing for a defendant to try years down the road to attack their conviction is to say, you know, I wanted to testify in my defense, but my attorneys told me I couldn't and wouldn't let me. And so increasingly, federal judges, to head that off someday, will ask a defendant on the record, outside the presence of the jury, do you want to testify? You can if you want to. And then that forecloses that argument that defendants like to make.
Okay, let's turn to the closings. Let's start broad, because you've been a prosecutor and now you're a defense attorney. How do you approach a closing?
Many skeptics will say that by the closing, you've already won it or lost it. You know, there's a lot of research that jurors make up their mind fairly early on, and that what a closing is doing is giving them the rationales they're going to use to get wherever they've decided to go already. But those of us who do it for a living like to imagine, at least, that we're up to something, that we're doing something worthwhile in the closing. And the idea is to marshal all the evidence that's happened and explain to the jury why it supports your side. Because you can't argue during a trial. You can't argue in an opening statement. You can only tell the jury what you expect the evidence will show. You can't argue with witnesses. So when it comes down to saying why your evidence should be believed and why the other side shouldn't, the closing argument is the main event. And it's the time to put all the evidence in context, to explain to the jury how it fits together and how it refutes the other side. And most importantly, to fit that into your story, your narrative, the big picture thing that you want the jury to buy.
Yeah. And so to that end, the prosecutor, Greg Andres, came out and he basically had two big broad themes here about what Paul Manafort did wrong, which is to say that Paul Manafort lied to the government to avoid paying taxes on his income. And then when his income dried up, he lied to banks in order to obtain loans to continue financing the lifestyle that he had when he did have lots of income. And so when you're talking about, you know, turning the evidence into a story, this is a fairly complicated case. There's lots of documents, lots of numbers involved. And it really strikes me that a lot of what the prosecution was doing here was basically trying to demystify all of this information and show why it told stories about how Manafort had lied in one of those two ways, either hiding his income from taxes or obtaining bank loans that he wouldn't have been able to get if he'd disclosed his true financial condition.
And that's exactly right. I think they pretty deftly reduced it down to those two ideas and linked them together and then explained how all those different witnesses and documents played into that. They were telling more of the story they started with in the opening that Judge Ellis occasionally interfered with.
And so I thought there was this one interesting moment where he's talking about the defense, which is basically that Rick Gates was responsible for all the bad acts here and that Paul Manafort didn't know exactly what was going on with his money. It was Rick Gates, partly in order to embezzle money from Paul Manafort, who was pulling these shady dealings with the money. And he says, look, you know, they've put out this paper trail for years and years of all of the income that accrues in foreign accounts that belong to Paul Manafort, and then all the money that is moved into the United States to pay Paul Manafort's expenses out of these accounts. And he says basically what the defense is claiming here is that Gates or some other unknown person forged Paul Manafort's signature on accounts, put $60 million in them, and then allowed Paul Manafort to use $15 million of that money on his lavish lifestyle, buying clothing and cars. And Andres says to the jury, does that make any sense at all? We should be so lucky. And he actually got a laugh out of part of the jury when he said that.
Right. And what's interesting about all of this is that even though this is an extraordinary case, you know, the president's campaign manager connected to a special counsel investigation, so much publicity, so much history, so many of the arguments are very familiar, and you could see down into a run-of-the-mill dope case. The argument the prosecutor is making is pushing back against the idea that the case hinges on Gates. They're saying, no, it doesn't. Gates is just flavor for you. Gates just supports the documents that are the star. And that's a very traditional argument, an argument that refutes the defense's attempt to make it all about this crook Gates. And it's a very standard move. And so is the defense's response.
Yeah, and so a couple of other ways that they try to sort of turn the defense's fixation on Gates on its head, they basically say, for one thing, you know, the defense keeps telling you Gates is crooked. It's like, yeah, well, Gates is crooked. He's the guy that Paul Manafort selected in order to complete these criminal schemes with him, so it's not going to be some Boy Scout. And then there was also all this stuff about Rick Gates having one or more extramarital affairs, and that was brought out in Gates's testimony. And the prosecution basically attack the defense for focusing so much on Rick Gates's infidelity, basically saying, who cares? This is a shiny object in order to distract the jury. What does it tell you that they talk about this so much? It tells you that their case is weak.
And, I mean, again, this is all traditional stuff. The argument that basically when you're prosecuting creeps, you're not going to have nuns and priests around to testify is a very classic prosecutorial argument. And I think what they're doing fairly effectively is letting the defense run as hard as it wants to with this attacking Gates and just showing how that is a shiny object and how it does kind of undermine them a little bit. It's easy when you're taking the strategy of attacking the cooperating witness to take it too far. And that's what I think they're trying to point out here, that in doing this all-out attack on Gates, they're ignoring the good parts of the prosecution's case.
And then finally, on the prosecution's close, most of this trial has been sort of surprisingly unrelated to U.S. domestic politics, even though it's, you know, obviously this is the trial of the president's former campaign manager, and there is enormous political significance to this trial. But there was one significant link between this prosecution and the 2016 campaign, and that's sort of the tail end of Manafort's schemes to finance himself through ill-gotten bank loans. loans, as the prosecution alleges, $16 million in loans from a bank called Federal Savings Bank, whose chief executive, Steve Calk, sought a job in the Trump administration, actually provided Manafort with a rank-ordered list of jobs he was interested in with Secretary of the Army at the top of that list. And they're basically alleging that this was a fraudulent scheme where Calk was causing these loans to be approved so that Manafort could finance his lifestyle. And in return, he thought that he might get an administration job through Paul Manafort.
Yeah, and the list that Calk sends is pretty stark. It's really a wish list of, these are all the jobs I'd like in the order that I might like them. And it was one of the few notes about the Trump White House and the Trump campaign. And it was pretty gross. And I think that the prosecution capitalized on that in closing. And it will be interesting to see whether anything comes of it in the long run with respect to Calk.
Do you think this was an effective close overall?
Well, again, I only read about it and read, nearly sentence by sentence recaps of it. I wasn't there to see it, but it had all the ingredients of an effective close. It hit the notes I think they had to, and it didn't fall into the big traps that you worry about. So I think they did what they could with what they had.
So let's talk about the defense closing. And so the defense's case the whole way along has been basically that Paul Manafort was duped by Rick Gates, who's moving the money around without his knowledge, in part because he was stealing from Paul Manafort, and that now Rick Gates is lying to put Paul Manafort in prison so that Gates can get a plea deal. And so you look at the themes in the defense closing, and it seemed to me, and again, this is just from reading the accounts of it since this trial is not broadcast, it seemed a little more scattershot than the prosecution close. A few of the themes were basically, a paper trail can fool you, emails can be out of context, so you can't just rely on emails to figure out what happened. You need to hear testimony, but none of the witnesses who are testifying are trustworthy. Rick Gates can't be believed. This accountant was somehow duped into believing that she had committed a crime when she really hadn't. They argued that Paul Manafort is a man who devoted his life to public service and sought to do good things, and that there was no proof of his intent to commit a crime in the evidence that the prosecution put forward. And they sort of hit this theme over and over again, that just because you put something inaccurate on a tax return or on a loan application, that's not necessarily fraud. You have to intend to defraud. It has to not just be a mistake. And they were arguing that basically these things could have been, a mistake, or maybe he intended to use the apartment for his personal use in the future, so it wasn't fraud to tell the bank that it was a primary residence. And then finally, they argued basically that this is a politically motivated overcharging, that the special prosecutor started rooting around, and that's the only reason this case ended up getting brought at all. So what do you make of that sort of that pile of arguments?
Well, again, when you're on the defense, you argue what you have to argue. The defense is whatever it has to be. And the attacking the government's proof of intent is the obvious play here. They do have to prove not just that the tax returns and bank loan applications were inaccurate. They have to show that they were knowingly inaccurate. And when you have a lot of complicated issues and numbers, that's a very popular argument to make. And this again goes back to what I said, that different lawyers will tell you different things, whether they think that in a closing you're persuading the jury or whether you're giving them the tools and excuses and tropes they're going to use to come to the conclusion they've already decided on, whether you're sort of feeding things to say that they're going to attach to the story they've decided to believe. And sometimes an argument can be somewhat cynical like that. It can just give people catchphrases that they're going to use to justify to themselves and their fellow jurors about how they're coming out. You have to bear in mind that the defense here, in effect, wins if they can keep even one juror from voting to convict. It has to be a unanimous jury, so they can hang the jury if they have just one person on there willing to throw up their hands and say, all this is gibberish, I don't believe it, I'm not convinced, even without really engaging with the evidence on a deep level. So I think they had to kind of go with generalities like what you're describing, because there's some very damaging documents and communications and emails there. The communication where Manafort's telling his son and daughter-in-law, remember the appraiser of this place thinks you're living there, tending to corroborate fraud. The emails where he's telling people this is my account. There's all sorts of things corroborating what he knew and when he knew it. And to get the jury to basically discount those, you have to get them to buy into a bigger picture idea. And that's what I think the defense is trying to do.
One of my favorite arguments in this closing was basically that Manafort can't have been intending to commit a fraud because if he were intending to, he would have done a better job of it. This is how the Washington Post describes that argument. It says, describing the defense attorney, after attacking Gates, Attorney Downing sought to stress for jurors how complicated Manafort's taxes were and how his actions were too transparent to support the idea that he was trying to hide money from the IRS. Downing said jurors would have expected to see a scheme to conceal, but instead they could sift through wire transfer records that listed the names and numbers of Manafort's accounts. How, Downing asked, could that be a grand concealment? It doesn't make any sense, he said. Downing also highlighted that in 2014, both Gates and Manafort told the FBI about their Cyprus accounts as the Bureau was pursuing a Ukraine-related investigation. So is this a defense you see a lot, basically, like, you know, my client is too smart to have committed a crime this obvious?
It is, and it's definitely an argument that defense lawyers make sort of tongue-in-cheek, because the argument that a defendant couldn't possibly have intended to do something so dumb is not a viewpoint that generally survives prolonged contact with defendants. So you're kind of hoping the jury will buy that your client is straight, but even if he's not a good person, even if he's not doing the right thing, that if he were doing the wrong thing, he would do it better. That's a tricky argument to make, and I think a lot of us understand that even sophisticated people do really stupid things, which is why the defense doesn't work that often.
So one interesting aspect of this defense close is that they brought up this idea of a political prosecution and basically said that the special counsel cobbled together information to stack up counts against Manafort, basically because he was there to sniff around people around the president. And after the jury had been excused, the prosecutor, Greg Andres, stood up and he argued that the defense had violated several agreements, that they were not supposed to bring up the idea that the prosecution had been politically motivated. They also weren't supposed to bring up this idea that there should have been an IRS audit to catch Paul Manafort, and that, you know, it shouldn't have had to wait for a criminal investigation. And so the judge agreed with the prosecutor that the defense had violated the agreement about what could be discussed in the closing arguments by bringing these things up. And his remedy is that he's going to give the jury instructions about how they're not supposed to think about those things in deciding the case. Is that really a strong remedy there? And does that mean that if you're the defense lawyer, you might as well go ahead and break these agreements? Because all that's going to happen is the judge is going to tell the jury, well, ignore that thing that lawyer said.
You know, I don't know that it actually makes any difference, something like that, in the long run, because, again, I think juries tend to make decisions and then look for things that support those decisions. Do juries actually follow instructions? Can you unring a bell and tell them not to think about the elephant in the room once you've pointed to the elephant? I'm a little dubious about it, but I don't actually think that that type of argument, that type of point, winds up weighing too heavily in a jury's mind. It's not likely to be what they're focused on. It's very speculative. It's a little removed from what was actually being talked about. And I think that any jury that can be swayed by the idea, well, they could have done an audit, is probably a jury that was already swayed to begin with.
Judge Ellis also said to prosecutors that that they could have objected at the time as the defense was making its closing argument if they thought that the defense was in violation of those agreements. Is that typical, that one would raise objections in the middle of the other side's closing argument?
Sure. And some lawyers do it. And, you know, the upside, some people think, is that it throws the other side off their game. It can break their concentration. It can ruin the flow of their argument. The downside of it is it can really annoy the judge. And sometimes jurors really don't like it. They see it as unfair. They see it as you trying to be unsportsmanlike and break up the other person's argument. So it's a risky thing to do.
So as this case goes to the jury, you mentioned that, you know, the defense kind of only needs one juror to be sympathetic to them in order to hang the jury. But it's not just that you have, you know, many jurors. You also have many counts here. And so isn't it not just a matter that you have to convince some juror to be sympathetic to you, but they've accused Manafort of a wide variety of acts, many of which are substantially unrelated to each other. So isn't it, on a case like this, even if you have success in winning over one juror, isn't it also difficult to then win them over with regard to every single count, to convince them that, you know, whatever cause they have to distrust something about the prosecution's case, that it goes toward every count, and there's not one of them that survives whatever concern they have about some somebody's credibility or something like that.
And that's exactly right. You know, jurors are instructed that they're not supposed to bargain or horse trade or, you know, okay, I'll agree not guilty on this count if you agree guilty on that count. But they do. And everyone knows that they do. And the way that federal sentencing works is that it really doesn't ultimately make a big difference how many counts you get convicted of. All the wrongdoing you've been accused of is going to get totaled up and, you know, made into numbers and turned into a recommended sentence. And that sentence, for someone like Manafort at least, is likely it's not going to make a big difference if he gets hit with, say, 4 counts or, say, 40 counts. The sentence doesn't wind up changing that much. So, yes, he needs somebody to basically say, you know, I think this whole thing is a mess. This whole thing is crooked. I'm not voting to convict on anything. And that's a somewhat tough sell.
So is that a reason that prosecutors charged so many counts? I mean, at the beginning of this case, you had Judge Ellis complaining that the prosecutors had brought more counts than was necessary.
It's true. And that's something federal judges love to complain about. And I remember being a rookie and having a federal judge accusing me of, you know, only doing 20 counts in a mail fraud indictment to impress girls. I'm not sure where this judge was accustomed to meeting members of the opposite sex or how he thought they were impressed. But judges hate that because, you know, it's an administrative burden. Everything takes longer. It takes longer to instruct the jurors. Prosecutors do it in part because it increases the variety of evidence that they can put on. So when you have a judge like Judge Ellis, who's very tough and is telling you, you know, this is irrelevant, I'm not going to let you to present evidence about it, you want to be able to say, well, judge, it's relevant to this count in the indictment right here. So prosecutors put counts into indictments to assure that they're allowed to introduce evidence on a particular subject. You might add a count that's somewhat weaker just so that you can get in the evidence on that issue. And it's not so much a thing about sentencing. Sometimes the nature of the counts makes a difference. You know, a mail fraud count carries more threat than, say, a minor lying to the government count. But ultimately, the number of counts doesn't make a big difference.
Let's take a short break. And right after that, Ken White and I will take some reader mail, and then we'll talk about Omarosa. We're back. We've gotten a lot of questions from listeners. And one thing that people are interested in is the potential aftermath of the Manafort trial. What would happen if Manafort is convicted and then pardoned? Kevin King asked us on Facebook, say Manafort is convicted and Trump pardons him. Would Mueller be able to subpoena Manafort and force him to testify to the grand jury under oath, exposing him to perjury and contempt if he doesn't answer? In other words, would the Fifth Amendment not apply? And in this scenario, do you think it's likely Manafort would testify to damaging information about Trump? So, Ken, on this point, basically, the Fifth Amendment creates a right against self-incrimination, but you can't self-incriminate if you've already been pardoned for the crimes that you're being asked about, right?
Right. The idea behind the Fifth Amendment is that you have a right not to testify if it could put you in jeopardy. And if the jeopardy is removed, then you can be compelled to testify. The trick here, I think, would be that Manafort would want to argue that he's not merely in jeopardy on federal charges, he could be in jeopardy on state charges. Or that if the pardon isn't broad enough, that there could be other related federal crimes that him testifying could put him in jeopardy on. But assuming that the pardon, if there is one, is broad enough and covers enough things that he's done, and assuming he could get some sort of judicial order and that state jeopardy does not appear to be an issue, then yes, a judge could compel Manafort to testify before the grand jury or any other proceeding where he's called.
I also want to ask you something about yelling judges, because this is something of a theme for you, getting yelled at by federal judges. Judge Ellis has done quite a bit of yelling during this trial. It's clearly frustrated prosecutors a great deal. And prosecutors actually, after one day of trial, submitted a request in writing that the judge apologize in front of the jury for rebuking them over a couple of matters, including allowing an expert witness to watch part of the proceedings when he was not himself testifying. And Judge Ellis actually sort of obliged. He didn't really say sorry, but he said that he probably should not have done what he did. What do you make of that? Because I know you were kind of laughing at the idea that an attorney would even bother asking a judge to apologize for yelling.
Well, yeah, what happened was that there was an expert witness who was going to be called. Typically, you exclude witnesses. That means when any one witness is testifying, all the other witnesses are outside of the room so that you know that they're testifying based on their own memory and not what they just saw in court. The expert witness stayed in the courtroom because the expert witness was going to offer an expert opinion, putting together all the different testimony. And the prosecutors asked for and got Judge Ellis's permission to do exactly that. And then when the expert hit the stand and the judge heard he'd been in the room, the judge yelled at them, forgetting, apparently, that he had told them that they could do that. And that is not a unknown type of moment in a federal courtroom. I think the reason that the prosecutors asked for some reaction to that was not because their feelings were hurt, but because they were worried that the rebuke hurt their credibility with the jury, and that they wanted, you know, they knew there was a lot they couldn't do. They couldn't, you know, get back at the judge for putting them down in front of the jury repeatedly on other issues, but at least on this one where the judge made a clear mistake and upbraided him for something he had given them permission to do, they could get him to walk it back a little bit, just so it would take a little sting out, not for their egos, but for their credibility with the jury.
Okay, let's get to the part everybody's been waiting for. Let's talk about Omarosa. She has been all over TV promoting her new book, which is full of dubious allegations. Most widely discussed, an allegation that she is aware of an outtake tape from The Apprentice where President Trump uses the N-word. This week, the Trump campaign served notice to Omarosa, trying to force her into a binding arbitration proceeding over her non-disclosure agreement with the campaign, basically trying to use this legal process to shut her up. Is that likely to work?
I don't think so, either legally or practically. So this is a non-disclosure agreement that she apparently signed with the Trump campaign, but they're using it to get her to shut up, or try to get her to shut up, not only about the campaign, but about things in the White House once she joined the White House. Now, a non-disclosure agreement may well be enforceable about a private entity, but it's extremely dubious that you could enforce one to get people to stop talking about their public service, their paid work as a government employee. And most of the legal commentators on this have agreed that it's unlikely that a judge would enforce it. There's a doctrine called unconscionability. It's the idea that the courts will not enforce a contract if that contract violates public policy or is otherwise inappropriate. And so it's you can't have a contract that says you promise not to report any crimes to the government. That's unconscionable. It's against public policy. And the idea is that restricting a public employee or a former public employee from talking about public service like that is unconscionable. So I think it's at least dubious that they'd be able to do this legally, even in front of an arbitrator. Practically speaking, if the idea is to keep her from talking and to prevent more information from getting into the public record, well, you just have to ask, how well did that work with Stormy Daniels? I think it's clear that this method, sending something to arbitration, is not working anywhere these days for the president in terms of suppressing information. It draws more press attention to it. The people tend to file some sort of case in other courts to prevent the arbitration. And that whole process is fraught with leaks, and all the information you were trying to suppress gets out. And, you know, it's a holiday for Michael Avenatti. And so I suspect that's what's going to happen here.
One thing I think is interesting about these agreements, and we have seen, I don't know precisely the text of what Omarosa signed, but we've seen one of these forms that was generally distributed to people who worked on the 2016 campaign, which would tend to include Omarosa. And this form has a clause against disparagement. So it's not just about confidential information or things that they learned in the process of doing work on the campaign. It also says that during the term of your service and at all times thereafter, you hereby promise and agree not to demean or disparage publicly the company, Mr. Trump, any Trump company, any family member, or any family member company, or any asset any of the foregoing own, and so on. And so basically, it's an agreement to never say anything bad about Donald Trump or his relatives ever for the rest of your life, or at least it would seem to say that. And that seems like, I mean, if you sign a document that says you will do that, can that actually be enforced against you?
Well, it's amazing how broad it is, isn't it? Because it's not just Trump. It's all Trump's family and all of the family businesses and all the assets. Again, it's something that when it's applied to government service, I think it's highly unlikely to be upheld. Non-disparagement clauses are not unusual and they are sometimes upheld, although they often, again, wind up drawing more attention than they put away. They're more of a deterrent than they are an effective way of keeping information out of the public record. But, you know, in terms of a judge enforcing a non-disparagement that you can't criticize as a former government worker or the president of the United States you worked for, I would be shocked if any judge upheld a term like that.
So this is an agreement from the campaign, and it's been the campaign trying to enforce this. The president has also been having White House staff sign non-disclosure agreements, which is a break with previous White House practices. And so a lot of people have been asking, you know, even if these campaign NDAs can be enforced in certain ways with regard to certain information, can these agreements that he's been having public employees sign be enforced? And who do the agreements even benefit? Because, you know, those employees, they don't work for Donald Trump. They work for the United States government.
Well, exactly. And even though, yes, the Omarosa agreement, several others are nominally on behalf of the Trump campaign, which is over, they're being used to silence speech about the Trump White House. So they're functionally being used as if they were signed during the time he was president. The ones that were actually signed when he was president, I think that the justifications for a court upholding those and punishing a government worker for revealing things about the operation of government are even more feeble. And I think that, again, the chance that the Trump administration can use these agreements to keep information, to keep criticism or juicy tidbits out of the media is effectively nil. It's a way to try to threaten people. It's a way to lash out at them. But is it actually going to suppress information? I very seriously doubt it.
Speaking of juicy tidbits and strange people, let's talk for a second about Roger Stone, the dirty trickster political consultant, actually former business partner of Paul Manafort's and loosely associated with the Trump campaign. An associate of his, Randy Credico, who is this kind of weirdo comedian from New York, has been subpoenaed by the special counsel's team. And it's thought Mueller wants to hear from him about his dealings with Stone and also with Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. Stone has claimed that Credico was a go-between for him and Assange. And Stone got angry when Credico publicly denied being a go-between. He sent Credico an email that said, quote, prepare to die, and then it was followed with a colorful and obscene slur sometimes used for homosexuals. Stone says that email wasn't a threat, that it was an expression of support related to Credico's prostate cancer diagnosis, which is already a hilarious and ridiculous thing to say, made more ridiculous by the fact that Credico says that he's never had prostate cancer and never claimed to have prostate cancer. What legal significance, if any, does this have?
Well, I think Stone should have gone with the argument that there's crucial punctuation somewhere in that sentence that was missing that changed the meaning. Well, it's not clear. I mean, this is all antics by some of the weirdo peripheral figures, and I think largely a distraction from the central figures. All these people are looking for ways to posture to signal to the special counsel what the facts are without having to say things under oath. And they're trying to get people to support them without those people having to testify under oath. But it's pretty clear that the special counsel, to the extent necessary, will go to court and compel people to testify. And I suspect that Robert Mueller and his team are ignoring all this sorts of nonsense and that they don't particularly care about Roger Stone making these types of bizarre statements unless it's directly to them, and that their goal is to get him to commit himself as much as possible. You know, in one of our very earliest episodes, we talked about how one of the things federal prosecutors do is turn up the heat and then just watch as everyone does stupid things. And this is a great example. The heat is turned way up on Credico, on Stone, on all these peripheral figures, and they're just flailing around, doing things, saying things that can later be used as evidence against them, that can be used to pressure them, and generally that hems them in for what their defenses might be if they're ever charged.
So speaking of people trying to find ways to avoid testifying, there's another associate of Stone's named Andrew Miller, whose strategy has been simply to refuse to testify before a grand jury. And a federal judge found him in contempt of court for his refusal to testify. So what would the reason for this sort of thing be? I mean, can't you just take the Fifth Amendment before the grand jury if you're worried about self-incrimination? Why refuse to testify and then end up in contempt?
Well, there could be a few reasons. Some people don't want to take the Fifth because they view it as an admission that they did something wrong, and so for political reasons, they're trying to avoid that. Sometimes you might be able to get a judge to overcome the assertion of the Fifth, which means even either giving the person immunity, getting a ruling that there's no basis for them to think that this would incriminate them, which winds up being the same as immunity, because then once you've found that, you can't prosecute them. And there could really be reasons of stubbornness. The person just really does not want to testify for philosophical or friendship reasons. And my understanding is that it was Miller's attorneys who asked the judge to make a finding that he was in contempt on this issue. And the reason for that would be to tee up the issue for an appeal, to go to the Court of Appeals and try to get them to overturn the order compelling him to testify.
Finally, let's talk some about Michael Avenatti. First of all, Michael Avenatti blocked me on Twitter. I don't know whether it was something I said. I tweeted when Avenatti has been running around Iowa saying that he's going to run for president, I tweeted that America deserves this. And for all he knows, that could have been a compliment, like that he's great and we deserve to have him as president. So, Ken, I'm going to be relying on you to let me know, for example, when Michael Avenatti announces that he's Omarosa's attorney in this arbitration action.
Well, Josh, I hate to tell you, but I think all our listeners are going to back me on this. I think free and open communication is essential for leadership of this podcast. So look at me. I'm the captain now.
We'll have to have you read the intro script next week.
Exactly. People on Twitter, I block people just because they annoy me in some easily annoyed moment. I think you probably did tweak him a little bit. He, like so many of the other players in this circus we're watching, is a person with a bit of an ego. And maybe you just didn't take as seriously his presidential aspirations as he feels they should have been taken. And I don't know that serious is the word I'd use to describe the idea that Michael Avenatti should run for president. But in 2018, I don't think I can call it implausible.
Oh, I think he'd be a great president, like he has great hair.
Now, that one I take personally.
So let's talk about his exploration of a presidential run. Is there an ethical conflict here? He's exploring a political campaign against Donald Trump while he is an attorney in a legal action against Donald Trump representing another party. Can't that create a conflict of interest? You know, as he thinks about his position vis-a-vis Donald Trump with regard to the campaign, that could affect the way that he thinks about representing Stormy Daniels' interests in her lawsuit against Trump?
Well, it would more directly be a conflict if he represented Trump. Which is something that hasn't happened yet. But again, 2018, I can't completely rule it out. But the way it could be a conflict is that if his personal and business interests as a presidential candidate conflicted with the interests of one of his clients suing Trump. So he might have interests in doing something in the litigation that's vivid and hurts Trump in a particularly cinematic way. He might have interests in taking stances in the litigation that are helpful to his political affairs, but are not as necessarily as helpful to his client's best interests. So that could be a conflict, but it's hypothetical. It's a potential conflict, not an actual conflict, unless someone can point to something that shows that basically it's in Stormy Daniels' interest to do something low-key, and it's in Avenatti's interest to do something flamboyant, and so far that hasn't happened.
Who would be the person who would point to that? I mean, the obvious person would be Daniels herself, but presumably it's Avenatti's job to assess those interests of hers as her attorney. Isn't the problem that she's depending essentially on Avenatti to assess the conflict of interest that Avenatti might have?
Sure. She could raise it herself. I mean, she's free to fire him. A judge hearing the case could raise it on his or her own. And sometimes the opposing counsel in a case can point it out, although that's usually seen as tactical and somewhat disfavored by the judge. The thought is you're not sincerely concerned about that conflict. You just want to get rid of this annoying attorney. And but in normal circumstances, it might pass by. Here, where everything is writ large on TV, and I'm sure he'll be talking about it repeatedly on cable, I imagine it'll come to the judge's attention. And that if it seems like a big enough issue, it would be the judge who might bring it up.
At least if Avenatti becomes president, we can probably keep doing this exact podcast about a similar legal morass surrounding a president. So I guess, you know, from our interests, we are entirely in favor of an Avenatti campaign, an Avenatti nomination, and an Avenatti election victory. I think we should leave it there, Ken. There is so much more to talk about, but I want to thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
We have another Left, Right, and Center episode coming for you on Friday, and Ken will be with us. If the jury delivers a verdict before we tape on Friday, we will talk about that. Also, confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh are beginning soon, at the beginning of September. We're going to talk more about his judicial record, also about the primaries this week, and about abuse in the Catholic Church. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And if there's something you've been wondering about the president, the porn star, and all the president's lawyers, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. This program is produced by Sarah Fay. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and I'll be back on Friday with Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.